The fact is that the utility bill itself is so complex. There's literally tens of thousands of rate structures out there. They're constantly changing, being updated, tweaked, and manipulated on the back end by the utility. And on the one hand, it's evolved organically over the last 120 plus years, where it's just a fragmented system. And therefore, frankly, our electric bills are all over the place. You look at one electric bill and PG&E versus Southern California Edison versus National Grid out on the East Coast. They're generally structured similar, but boy, there are some different terminology. And so when I think about energy management, it's a spectrum of opportunities and solutions one can take to take an act more active or a significantly active role in how one or how an organization uses energy.
This is A Sustainable Mind, where we delve into the minds behind today's most impactful environmental campaigns, organizations, and startups, inspiring the environmental change makers of tomorrow. I'm your host, Marjorie Alexander. Today's episode is sponsored by Climate Talks, a new podcast series exploring sustainability and the ways that we communicate about climate. In season one, Sophia Lee, journalist, film director, and self-described climate optimist, takes on topics from water stewardship and the circular economy to climate justice and communication. We'll be hearing a bit about Climate Talks later on in today's episode. This is episode 87, and today we are joined by Seth Manser, a longtime sustainability advocate, Marine Corps veteran, and business development consultant in the energy industry for over 10 years. Seth has developed a deep understanding of a multitude of energy management solutions, and his work serves the energy needs of commercial, industrial, and nonprofit organizations. His primary objective being to help organizations take a proactive approach to evaluating and taking action on their energy needs. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marjorie, for having me.
So we get started with every single episode the exact same way, and that is, how did nature, the environment, and sustainability play a role in your childhood growing up?
Absolutely. So for those that haven't heard my story, I grew up in a very small town on the Vermont border, Western Massachusetts. It's a 12-acre parcel, 120-year-old apple trees, and just surrounded by farms, grew up gardening. My father really led on the gardening side, and my mom had a strong influence on living a healthy and active lifestyle as a gym teacher, longtime employee and advocate at the local YMCA. And being outside, being active, having fun all seasons of the year, when it's snowy in winter, when it's hot in the summer, there's something fun and cool to do outside, just created kind of a baseline lifelong love of being in the environment. And then as I got older, finding ways that I can be a positive participant, contributor to the environment.
Very cool. Very cool. So in terms of your upbringing and its impact on your experiences as a young adult and your career path towards sustainable energy and energy management, how exactly did those two things come together? Was sustainable energy something that you were looking at when you were a young adult, or how exactly did you wind up on that career path?
It's a great question, and I took an interesting path. So on the one hand, my father has been in residential and small commercial construction much of my life. I was monkeying around on rafters and construction sites probably before I ever should have. That gave me a flavor and understanding of the built environment, what goes into it, and also how that impacts our day-to-day life. As I was getting towards the end of high school, I didn't quite feel ready for college, though I'd been accepted to a couple. And I took a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction, senior high school, was in the Marine Corps, looking for adventure, looking to get out of a small hometown. And it was a little bit of a different flavor of green, Marine Corps green, for those that have, of course, seen the camouflage. And that experience was very important for me, both in a kind of a professional jumping off, going from a boy, teenager, to a young man. And that rite of passage, along with my deep history in the environment, as I was in the Marine Corps Reserve, I started to find ways to knit the two together, bringing the leadership principles and national security perspective from the Marine Corps. And I started to dovetail that with building science classes I was taking in college. And that eventually took me down a path of studying at an eco-village in northern Scotland and teaching in private and public schools for a couple of years. Initially, I thought that was going to be my calling to help further the sustainability movement and sustainable communities. Instead, I felt a little bit frustrated with the focus on data in the public school side. And about that time, I was introduced to the concept of energy deregulation. And this really connected with me in a way that I could sign up for and help others go green without installing anything, no super long-term commitments. And that kind of got me into the green energy space. And from there, it's been a fun endeavor, combination of learning more and more about the complexities of energy, and then finding ways to simplify it. And my mantra throughout today, and for those that know me, is it's encouraging people to take action. And everybody can do something on the residential, commercial, industrial, municipal scale. It's a matter of kind of having somebody kind of guide you through some of the initial steps one could take, along with a clear what's in it for you.
Awesome. Awesome. And thank you for your service, by the way. Both of my grandfathers were veterans. And so that's something that is very close to my heart. I'm not a veteran. My parents aren't either, but both my grandfathers were. And I always have a special spot in my heart for veterans. So thank you for that. Also, and this is a little bit off topic, but in terms of the eco village in northern Scotland that you mentioned, would you mind giving us that name if that still exists?
Absolutely. So the name of the eco-village is called Findhorn, and it's in northern Scotland. And the way that I was able to connect with that opportunity through UMass Amherst was an organization that unfortunately no longer exists. They were called Living Roots, R-O-U-T-E-S, based out of Amherst, Mass. They connected with students with eco-villages all around the world for really intentional in-community learning. Each eco-village has a different perspective or focus, if you will. Oroville in India, Findhorn in Scotland, Huelva in Mexico. Each one kind of has a different focus. I chose Scotland partly because my family is from the UK. My mom did a bike tour around Scotland in college. So it kind of felt like a fun family connection. And also the theme of that study abroad program in Findhorn was sustainable development. At the time, there were just over 1,500 people living in or adjacent to the community, thriving community, just really amazing seeing such a functional community working where a lot of people have aspirations to live in community or create a community. A lot don't make it as long as Findhorn.
Wow, that is fascinating. And it's such a small world. I actually taught not summer school, but a summer program at Amherst when I was in college. So, wow. Who knows? Our paths might have crossed in the past.
Oh, that's very awesome.
So let's dive into talking about renewable energy and energy management. So when I was reading a little bit about you and your company, I saw this term energy management, and I thought to myself, what exactly does that mean? And also, what does it mean in terms of the commercial side versus the residential side? Most of our listeners are going to be homeowners or, you know, residents. They're not necessarily going to own businesses, or at least not businesses that have a brick and mortar location. So what does energy management mean for, say, the typical listener of A Sustainable Mind?
So glad you asked. As I've said before, I'm going to keep repeating, energy is an unnecessarily complex domain. And my hope is that as I get into the wonk and some of the weeds of clean tech and energy, is that everybody takes away the mantra of you can do something, call somebody. because it's worth it. When I think about energy management, generally speaking, most people, so that's individuals at their houses and the way organizations handle their energy, is generally an unmanaged situation. And I mean that most people get a bill at the end of the month. They might be happy, they might be a little frustrated, but we all pay the bill. And if we don't pay the bill, then the utility will cut us off in 45 to 90 days, mm-hmm. unless we have some extenuating circumstances. And the fact is that the utility bill itself is so complex. There's literally tens of thousands of rate structures out there. They're constantly changing, being updated, tweaked, and manipulated on the back end by the utility. And on the one hand, it's evolved organically over the last 120 plus years, where it's just a fragmented system. And therefore, frankly, our electric bills are all over the place. Mm-hmm. Look at one electric bill in PG&E versus Southern California Edison versus National Grid on the East Coast. They're generally structured similar, but boy, there are some different terminology. And so when I think about energy management, it's a spectrum of opportunities and solutions one can take to take an more active or a significantly active role in how one or how an organization uses energy. And we can kind of go through the escalation of kind of the first steps up and up through some of the various solutions that can apply. And for as listeners are kind of listening for keywords that are meaningful to you in your life, if you hear me say residential or commercial, most of the time those are kind of an interchangeable term. When it's specific to the non-residential space, I'll make sure that I define what those solutions are.
I definitely have seen some serious discrepancies between electric bills from two different companies within the same community or the same neighborhood or at least the same city for approximately what I would think would be the same energy usage. And I'm thinking of properties that are owned by my family, specifically down in Texas. We've got a home here, we've got a home there, and the bills are completely different. They're on two, you know, different utility companies. And I think that there are even some companies that do it based on your previous usage, like a lot of water districts do that. So I definitely assume that there are plenty of listeners out there that are like, yes, please tell me more about how I can manage this, because it's seriously confusing and it is annoying. But you're right. If you do not pay it, at the end of the day, your lights are going to be shut off. So this is a definite necessity for most of us that are not living off of the grid or have some other way of producing our own energy. So yes, definitely go on. And then I also want to talk about, you know, what are some of the first steps, specific steps that homeowners can take and people that don't necessarily own their property can take to take more control over their energy usage?
Absolutely. So where I'm really focused on is first education. And a lot of people, a lot of listeners may have heard of the concept of an energy audit. And there are a certain amount of utilities around the country that offer an energy audit, quote unquote, for free. But if you look at the electric bill, it's generally one of the line items that you're paying for. And so I would just kind of like to dispel that myth that most of the energy audits are technically not free. And so when I look at what an energy audit is, I like to think about it first as an educational session to make sure that person, organization, understands how the bill even works. What are they paying for? And then going to the physical walk through the building. But before I go to the physical side, a couple of really interesting points that you brought up on the electric bill. For listeners that are, I'm not sure where all the listeners, where you might be, but you're going to fall into a couple of the general camps. There is the markets that are what's called deregulated, and some are deregulated just for electricity or natural gas, and some markets are for both. And the reason that that word deregulation is really important is that up until the late 90s, virtually all of the utilities across the country were a vertically integrated monopoly. That means you just paid the bill. You didn't have really any choice of where the electricity was generated. Certain states after about 1998 started to come on board. And for, if you're listening in California and you're cringing, you might have been part of the Enron blackouts in the early 2000s. Sad moment. It was just really sad. It frankly, it gave the entire industry a black eye. And take a quick tangent there. The Enron bought the generation assets, so the power plants, and they also owned the lines. So they were incentivized to make power as expensive as possible. That's not good for ratepayers. That's not the intent of deregulation. For anybody that's seen the movie The Smartest People in the Room, that's the name, it's, I think it's on Netflix. Boy, it's kind of sadistic how they went through and really crippled California for a period of time. They go off of that tangent where California re-regulated, and in that time, other states learned the lessons from California. And since then, California has done flavors of deregulation. And from, I believe it's episode 68 here on the Sustainable Mind podcast, Ted from Clean Power Alliance is an exact example of deregulation in the community choice aggregation space. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in Texas, the entire market of ERCOT, which is its own independent service operator territory, because Texas was its own country at one point. So it's kind of some fun, interesting little nuances where Texas kind of behaves differently. And everybody in Texas automatically needs to select a third-party supplier. So the utility that delivers the power is simply the delivery and distribution transmission company. And then you automatically have to select a supplier. That supplier, generally speaking, is offering the cheapest blend of energy. And increasingly, we're finding that solar and wind in particular are some of the most cost-effective ways to source power. Not always the cheapest. And as we get into the details of how, why, when, where, solar, wind, storage, other solutions, it's not a, doesn't perfectly fit everywhere in the country, but we'll get in that in a little while. So as you're looking at your electric bill, you have your delivery portion. That's how the electrons get from the power plant to your house or business. Mm-hmm. The supply section is where the electricity is actually generated. If you're in California and you've chosen a CCA, a community choice aggregation, it's going to be a lot more pages of bills that you have to sift through. So as you get your PG&E bill, you have your one meter, it's about three pages of bills. And then if you have a community choice aggregation that selected Monterey or fill in the blank, that is going to show up as another page. And this is just one of the elements that makes bill analysis tricky. So once you've now made that choice for that CCA, you now have another page, another bill over here. It's not all in one neat place and one neat bar graph. That's where some of the wheels already start to fall off, where when you make the decision, they run the numbers, they say, okay, I'll pay the same amount for mostly green power or maybe a little bit more for 100% green power. And then they get the bills and it's just pretty complex. Most people that have signed up 6-12 months later aren't quite sure how or why the bill represents what they're actually using. Mm-hmm. And then in other markets, you have, so the, what I'm talking about with PG&E, Southern California Edison, National Grid, Duke, those are the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities. And that's an important distinction to make because the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, those organizations, those utilities are have to live by the state's Department of Energy Resources or Department of Public Utilities in a different way than the municipal co-ops. And a municipal co-op, a brief example, is you have your Department of Public Works. They might manage your water and your sewer. And in some towns, they also manage the electricity grid. And in particular, the rural electrical co-ops were part of the FDR's initiative back in the 30s and 40s for the electrification of the rural landscape. Out in Iowa and a number of places around the country, electrical co-ops are still in existence. And what's great to see is all across the country, we're seeing a lot of co-ops coming together, locking arms and buying a wind turbine, buying a solar array. Going back to the Findhorn example, they invested in 4 wind turbines that export power back into the grid in Northern Scotland. And there's all sorts of kind of innovative structures. But getting back to the utility bill, there's a ton of structures that are increasingly complex. And I'll just give a couple examples specifically in California, but this is really representative of utility bills in a lot of markets. How you are billed for energy is not the same all day long and all year long. Mm-hmm. So in California, there's a number of rate payers. When you look at your bill, you have on-peak, off-peak, mid-peak, and maybe even super-peak. And then you'll also, if you track your bills month to month, you'll see that things flip, winter versus summer, generally in May and November. So just when you thought that you got your handle on how you're using power to best optimize your bill, the utilities then change the hours of those time of use windows, like they did most recently with net metering 2.0 in California. And then if you're a non-residential energy user, some residential programs do include demand, mostly non-residential, where demand it's a bit of a complex concept to really describe, but there's organizations that spend 10 to 50+% of their electric bill because the utility has them at set tiers of demand. And so if you turn on all your machines in a 15-minute window, huge surge of power, and that power management mistake, if this goes back to the energy management conversation, by mismanaging power and turning all your devices on in a 15-minute window, that can have implications for the next 12+ months, where you're now paying for energy that you might not need, but the utility is now charging you to make sure that all that energy is available at your curb in case you need it.
Seth, I have a question for you.
Yes.
As far as the community aggregate programs, obviously, they can choose to produce the energy using whatever, solar, wind, et cetera. But do they also provide additional storage so that this whole, you know, having to buy power when you need it and then the price is, you know, much higher than it typically would be because the timing is just, you know, it's just off. Is that something that's addressed by community aggregate programs? That question makes sense?
The question does make sense. And this is where it gets a little bit tricky. You know, as from what I understand on the community aggregation side, it's you have a certain solar asset, say a 2 MW, 8 acres of solar, and that 2 MW solar array is producing 2.5, 2.8 million kilowatt hours a year at a set price. And then whatever you use, you pay for. In terms of the storage, there are market reasons to install solar at existing solar arrays that are on. That is one thing that we are doing. We have a couple of, large battery projects, not tied to solar, but that can help manage the voltage from the grid. When it comes to on-site, storage on-site does have the greatest impact in terms of preventing the grid from getting too hot, frankly, during like wildfire season. Mm-hmm. But I want to double back to your question, just make sure I'm going down the right path. Your question about CCAs and applicability of energy storage systems, is that
correct? Yeah, I guess. I mean, when I think about CCAs, I think, you know, how does this benefit the user, or how does this benefit the resident on multiple levels? So there are several different ways that we're kind of getting, you know, kicked in the teeth from power companies. And one of them is, you know, the inflation of the prices, because you're having to buy more electricity at night when the sun's not out and when, you know, the wind may or may not be, you know, up doing its thing. So in those cases, in addition to just where, like you were talking about at the beginning, when you're looking at your bill, there's the source, which is how the energy is generated, but also the storage. And I'm just wondering if CCAs are also addressing the storage piece in order to, you know, hold on to the power that they do generate, because these are obviously smaller groups, right? Their grids are not, or maybe their grids are integrated with the normal grid. Like, this is where I start to go off and I'm like, I have no idea what I'm talking about.
And believe me, you are not alone. And this is one of the reasons why I take an educational approach to energy, because, you know, in order to even get to a decision point about any one of these measures that we're going to be talking about, you got to get into the weeds a little bit and mm-hmm. kind of get into the energy side. So maybe one way to think about it is maybe we'll kind of go on the energy management spectrum. So we started with the utility bill. There's a lot of nuance there. And then the other point, before we leave that, I just want to note, if you are charged for demand, the utility by law is required to give you access to your interval data. That's for a whole other topic, what you do with the interval data, but love to, you know, maybe we'll get back to that when it comes to storage. Let's say you've got your electric bill, you've gotten logged into your electric account. Okay, now you have that access. The next step is understanding how and where you use energy in your facility. There's a host of different energy monitors that you can buy on the residential scale. There's Neurio, there's Sense. There's a lot of widgets that are popping up that you plug into your electric panel, whether it's you or a handyman or electrician, for a pretty small amount of money, generally less than, you know, an hour's worth of labor. And that'll give you granular second-by-second analysis of what you use in your facility. So there's a mantra in life is, you know, what gets measured gets done, from like a goal setting perspective. So applying that to energy, what you measure, what you actually know, seeing that dehumidifier in your basement, kick on at 2 a.m. Like, I can now put a dollar figure to that dehumidifier. Mm-hmm. And Neurio and Sense and these other companies, they have some great analytics that and kind of help you really put together a real-time understanding of like, what does it mean to use my deep freezer in my basement? Maybe I should buy a new one. So moving on from now that we're tracking the energy, now let's start to make some decisions. Whether you own your property or you rent or you're your tenant, doesn't really matter. If you're in a market that allows you to choose your supply, whether that's community choice aggregation or a deregulated energy option, you're still connected to the grid. So lights won't flicker when you make these changes. There are some hyper local small microgrids that are starting to pop up. But even those microgrids, generally speaking, are all connected to the greater grid. And so when you make that choice, you know, you're looking at your bill, you're saying, okay, I could continue to buy electricity for, on the supply side, about 10 cents, 10, 11 cents from the utility, or I could go to a CCA for about the same amount of money and know that I am a subscriber to that solar farm five towns over. The exact electrons coming out of that solar farm may or may not ever actually go into your house, but it gives you a legitimate feeling that you are having an impact. And then in states that don't have these DAC deregulation options. There are organizations like Arcadia Power. I have a couple of friends that work there, and you can be in North Dakota and opt into green power. And you might not be connected with a solar or wind facility, even in your state, but they'll connect you with a renewable energy asset as close by. It might be in Iowa, like Kansas. And so that's a little bit more removed from the, you know, feeling, having that legitimate feeling that you're making an impact. But when you, the more that these companies are giving us detailed reporting, that you can really see that you're half of 1% of that solar project. Wow, okay, cool. That's meaningful. I can now kind of connect the dots between where I'm living, renting, owning, or where my business is. That's kind of the first thing is when you're choosing a CCA or third-party energy supply, lights don't flicker, you're still connected to the major grid. Generally speaking, it's an administrative change on your electric bill. It's an important change. It's a great first step because, frankly, as I'll get into it, solar can take a bit of time. Even if you want and you're really excited to go solar today, depends on where you are, it might take 3 months, it might take a year and a half or longer. But before we go too far down that tangent, Marjorie, back to you. So we've gone over kind of the education, some power tracking, energy tracking in one's facility, and then that first step of looking at a deregulated supply or CCA. And let me just kind of pause there, see what kind of question that might have stirred up for you. And
yeah, absolutely. So something that took me a while to kind of get my mind around, although, you know, that was a couple of years ago, but for if you're listening and, you know, these concepts are still a little new, in addition to this episode, like Seth mentioned, there's actually episode 68 with Ted Bartke of the California Clean Power Alliance. And that is also a great episode. But what Seth is talking about here is basically as a homeowner or a person that's leasing a place, when you're looking at your bill and you decide to switch to renewables, whatever the options are in your locale, you're basically putting money into this pot that goes to fund current and future clean power options. Like you said, even if those actual electrons aren't landing in your home to power your lights and your appliances. So that's kind of the most important thing, I think, just like on the very surface level, that people have challenges understanding, that I certainly had a challenge understanding a few years back. I definitely have a bit better of a grasp around it now. But if that's the case, and when it comes to this stuff, you know, I'm like, should I ask this question? Because I'm definitely going to get in the weeds. I'm a very, you know, I have an engineer's mind. I love math and science. So if that's the case, if when you're selecting renewables on your bill and that money is going into a pot that is to fund, you know, and help maintain these facilities that may or may not be near you physically, what happens? What does it look like when the US or at least a state gets to a tipping point where so many people are opting into clean energy? What then happens to the power companies? Like, is that going to have any blowback? Is that going to impact the residents for a certain period of time? Is it going to force the power companies to make a change and the residents aren't really going to be affected, and it's just going to make these CCAs, these community groups, more powerful? Like, what does that look like exactly? Because we're all doing these things in the now, but like, how does it impact the larger community in the long run? In kind of that in-between phase between like, okay, everybody's starting to go in that direction and like 100% renewable. Like, there's a little bit of a stopgap there. And I'm just trying to figure out what that looks like.
There's a huge, huge gap. And this is, anybody that says they know exactly how all this is going to play out, please give my number. I'd like to hear from them. We're undergoing something that's never happened in civilization.
Right.
Where, you know, we've gone from the utilities starting with a monopoly, and virtually from early 1900s up through 2000, there really wasn't any meaningful way to participate in or take control of your energy. I say that tongue-in-cheek because there is a lot that you can do, but the technology is, boy, it's come light years in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. The utilities, frankly, are having a bit of an existential crisis. They're kind of freaking out in certain markets and just pushing back totally. Like, I'm not sure. Like, we just want to keep our business model. You have some select utilities like Green Mountain Power up in Vermont that are really leaning into this, saying, well, what's good for our clients? What's good for our customers? What's good for the grid? What's good for the environment? How can we try to balance everybody's goals? And stuck in this push and pull is a number of well-intentioned and in a lot of ways, well-structured mandates. But the mandates are forcing utilities in some ways to go beyond where they're comfortable. And in a way, that's good. But the other, what's interesting is that overall, when I could summarize what's happening right now is it's the greatest democratization of energy in the history of the world, where we no longer have to be reliant on that one nuclear plant that powers half the state of Massachusetts. With hundreds of thousands of solar arrays, wind turbines in select places, things are really changing. And the simple answer is, I am not sure where all of this is going to go. But one thing that I hope the listeners really take to heart is that you have power over your power usage in your facility. Everybody has different levels of ability and resources available to them, but everybody can do something. And I will press on that the more you can do something that is on site, A, it will generally give you more value, and B, no matter what happens with a wider utility grid around you, you've now somewhat or significantly future-proofed yourself, your house, your organization from all this volatility in the future.
Okay, so what does that look like?
A little bit more, but I want to pause for a moment. Sorry, I just kind of went off on a little bit there.
No, I mean, I'm great, but you said that, I don't know the word that you used exactly. You did not use the word appliance. You used the word something that you could physically do on site. What does that look like exactly? Especially for homeowners or people that have, you know, brick and mortar physical places of business, but aren't like large companies. They're just, you know, mom and pop or small or mid-sized businesses.
Absolutely. So the first things you want to do are take advantage of the resources you have before you install anything. And so as we flip from the residential side, it can be done, it is being done, but it's a little more easier to explain at the commercial scale. So as you have an organization that has 2 to 5 HVAC units, that's heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, mm-hmm. generally speaking, the big units that sit up on top of a building, sometimes they're pad mounted on the outside of a building. What you can do is, with some great software that we work with, we can predict, well, we don't predict, we use some great meteorological data, day ahead, week ahead data to understand what's tomorrow gonna look like. And then we can overly cool or overly heat a building overnight. And that takes advantage of the thermal mass. Everything from the paper, the staplers, the desks, rugs, walls, windows, you name it, if it's physical, it's got some thermal mass to it. You can cool it down. And so the ideal there is in the middle of the day, because you've pre-treated and pre-conditioned the space overnight with cheap electricity, you're not having your HVAC units cycle on at the most expensive time of the day. Also, we find that doing this type of energy management helps reduce the amount of cycles that the HVAC unit in your boiler run, which lengthens the runtime. I've seen organizations go from cycling 15 to 30 times a day down to 2 to 3 times.
Wow.
Really strategic, optimal times. And that's one initial example. Nothing gets installed, That's a matter of working with a vendor like myself and or this host of them out there that help you manage the conditioned space using the existing thermal energy, in essence, using your building like a battery.
We'll get right back to the interview with Seth right after this. Today's episode is sponsored by Climate Talks. If you've ever listened to my welcome episode, then you may remember that one reason I started A Sustainable Mind was because I felt like everything that I was hearing, on podcasts especially, painted such a bleak picture of the climate situation. That doom and gloom mentality and narrative could make anyone feel like, no matter what they did, that it was already too late. Climate Talks is a new podcast that is showing us a new path, the path of the climate optimist. According to Sophia Lee, a climate optimist is a realist, but someone who is still hopeful about the future of our planet. If you haven't already guessed, I'm right there with Sophia. In each episode of Climate Talks, Sophia is inviting activists, scientists, experts, and listeners, people just like you, to the climate conversation. Check out Climate Talks now on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the interview.
So one thing that you said that kind of it took me aback was using electricity at night when it's cheap. I thought that electricity was expensive at night because it's dark and so everyone has their lights on and there's no sun out to generate more energy in real time. So you're using energy that's actually being stored, and that's why it would be more expensive. Do I have that backwards?
Well, so here's a different way to look at it. The average numbers that I've seen run anywhere from the transmission lines, the really big high tension wires that used to be out there, the big tall ones. Those generally run only at 10 to 40% capacity.
Okay.
So we have a huge amount of infrastructure in this country that's just not being used well. So if you're beating yourself up about not managing your household or your organization very well, don't worry. Our electric grid that, oh, by the way, the utilities make their money rate basing and building big assets like transmission lines, substations. That's how utilities make money. One quick aside, there is a substation Eversource in Massachusetts is trying to get installed just outside of Boston Logan Airport. And it's in an environmentally compromised community already, generally lower income, non-white demographics. It's a case example. And Attorney General from Massachusetts proved that this substation does not need to be installed. If the grid was just managed better, that substation doesn't need to be there.
Wow.
But getting back to the on-peak, off-peak conversation. So we have all these baseload assets. We have a whole bunch of, I'm not a fan of them, but there is natural gas, there is nuclear, there is a lot, and on the positive, there are wind turbines that still spin at night, thankfully. Not every night, but enough.
Right.
And because of the grid congestion being lower at night, it's simply cheaper to transmit electricity at night. For electrical engineers on the line, please don't cringe too much as I'm trying to describe the power sector in a couple seconds here. But in California, in Massachusetts, and a number of markets in between, you have particularly peak power prices that can go anywhere from 2 to 5 to 8 times the cost. So you might be paying power 7 cents per kilowatt hour at night. And in National Grid, Massachusetts, they give you 24 hours in advance, but they're going to charge you 63 cents, not 7 cents, if you use power during that 30 to 90 minute window during the day. And most people don't really know that. And then this is where you can start to stack different types of technologies and different solutions. I have yet to see any property have the exact same system size and solution. So it's a bit custom, but if you add, say, if you just have solar panels, no storage, And that solar, if the sun is shining, when you're using that peak energy in the middle of the day, you're first using the power from the solar before you draw from the grid. So using solar can be a great way to offset those high peak charges, but then enter net metering 2.0 in California and other utilities that are kind of shaking things up behind the scenes, where they're making power more expensive between the hours of, say, 4 to 6 p.m. Sun isn't shining all that much, but engineers on the line, you can point your solar panels west as the sun is setting and actually bump your power production up. You can have trackers that automatically tilt the power, tilt the panels to the optimal angle of the sun. All of these things, again, kind of get into the weeds, but ultimately everybody can do something, and solar might be right for you. And there's a ton of markets. I've done transactions over 13 states. It's price comparable or a significant value in savings. Mm-hmm. New Jersey has a killer program that's just ending. Pretty much I can sign up some commercial clients with a 0 cent PPA or 0 cent per kilowatt hour deal for 15 years. It's just crazy. But getting back to the on-peak, off-peak, Marjorie, how did that explanation kind of work with your prior understanding of nighttime versus daytime energy?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. All right. So Seth, we are winding down here. Why don't you wrap up for us some of the final things that we should kind of keep in mind, both as residents and owners of companies, when we're looking at energy management for ourselves.
That's it. Really appreciate this. It's been a really fun conversation. So they're coming into a landing here. Again, my mantra is everybody can do something, and I encourage everybody to take that first step. Right? The journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Mm-hmm. And that single step is kind of related to energy audits and education. So if you're looking at your electric bill, if you don't know something on there, there's a great glossary on your electric bill. Call your utility, log into your electric account. If you have access to your bill and interval data, if you have an interval data meter, install. Next thing is I encourage everybody to install an energy monitor device at your facility. If you're a renter, might have to talk to your landlord, but knowing when and how you use energy at your house or facility, super critical. And then you can also, if you're in a deregulated market, or you can choose a third-party energy supplier, community choice aggregation, that's a great step. And if you go solar or you do some other deeper retrofit after, you're not going to be harmed by choosing that supplier. There's different types of HVAC and energy use management where you can cool or heat your facility more at night when power is cheaper. You can install solar and or energy storage. And because of FERC order 841, storage facilities that are over a certain size can participate in wholesale markets. And so you can actually create revenue, as well as certain utilities have what's called demand response programs, where if you can limit or significantly, well, you can eliminate your electric usage at a specific period of time, the utility will pay you a pretty sizable amount. There are a number of programs around the country that are getting rolled out or are already available. All in all, there's a lot of things organizations can do to manage their energy. And taking that first step in, you know, if you're of the mindset of looking to help our country go 100% green, that's awesome. It's only going to get there through projects. Projects happen from contracts. Contracts happen from people that are curious, interested in seeing what their options are. So if you haven't had a detailed energy audit and thorough review in the last 12 months, highly encourage you to. And yeah, things are changing, and there's a whole lot of options continually evolving. And back to you, Marjorie.
Excellent. Perfect. And one last question. Can you give us a quick idea of the type of client that you all ideally work with, so we can see if any of our listeners out there would be the perfect client for you, and exactly what your territory is for where they would be located.
Sure. So I'm here in Massachusetts, and we've done projects all across the country. And as solar and increasingly alternative energy management solutions are making more and more sense, we could really take on clients in just about every state. Specifically, there's a kind of a threshold. As you get to organizations that spend more than $2,000 a month, that's where we're able to step in, provide financing and all sorts of other options. In between the residential scale and a $2,000 a month bill, it's a really hard project to get financed. There's a lot of work being done, but that's definitely a major need and growth area. If anybody is listening and looking to get into renewable energy space or is with a clean tech finance company, you know, please reach out to me if you have a really great finance solution for the smaller projects. So generally speaking, organizations over $2,000 a month. Most of our projects are on the coast, so the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and West Coast, Arizona, California. I've done projects in Mexico, Colorado, number of states. It's fun. There's a lot that we can do across different markets. And one tool that I found very helpful, there's a free version. The company is called Station A. I believe the website is app.stationa.com. What they've done is they've done an AI, artificial intelligence, like scan of all the buildings that they could find. There are more than 10,000 square feet in the country. And they've done some really interesting analytics of what the estimated building load profile is. Does solar and/or storage make sense? Here is what the potential or 100% likely utility tariff is. So it's a lot of great insight that you could get. I know a lot of people are annoyed at solar sales reps. And I, as being in solar sales myself, I am frustrated with solar sales. So if you don't want to pick up the phone and talk to somebody, do some Googling and hop on this website, Station A. And then if your facility is over 10,000 square feet, it's likely on there. You get some pretty interesting analytics and diagnostics of what it could mean to your organization to look at solar. And I could probably keep going, but Marjorie, I know we're coming to a landing here. Love to kick it back to you and how to come to landing.
Perfect. So now we're going to jump into our seven sustainable questions. The first of which is, can you share with us one longstanding habit that you believe has significantly improved your life?
Growing plants. House plants like succulents, spider plants, and even some fig trees in my house. Growing plants regularly keeps a nice practice of mindfulness, attention to detail, and there's nothing like having beauty and green in the middle of the winter.
Yes, absolutely. Agree with that. Now that I'm in Philadelphia, not Los Angeles, I definitely need to take a trip to the garden center and see what I can pick up. What is one new habit that you're cultivating in your life right now?
We're doing it right now. Creating and sharing content. I've had the intention of getting out there with blogs and podcasts for years. I've just had a perfection mindset, or I'm not sure why, but here we are. So thank you, Marjorie, for inviting me on. And I hope this has been valuable to you and your listeners.
Perfect. Many people look up to you and your work that you've done for your community, but whose environmental work do you admire?
There's two top people that come to mind. A gentleman named John Gerber, Dr. John Gerber, UMass, University of Massachusetts professor. He was my mentor, as well as a mentor to a host of other people pursuing a sustainable life. Amazing, amazing inspiration. And the second is William McDonough. He's the founder of the Cradle to Cradle movement. He's a material designer, designing things that can just be seamlessly integrated back into the natural systems or as a technical nutrient to create a super high quality product again. So we've been amazed at the work that both John Gerber and William McDonough have done.
Nice. Do you have one internet resource that you find helpful on a regular basis that you think would be beneficial to share with our listeners?
Absolutely. I spilled the beans a little bit. So the service is called Station A. Can't speak highly enough. It's a really amazing tool that helps you just kind of get a high level understanding. Does solar and or storage make sense for this facility? And they can just learn some great things and submit the Station A application.
And what book would you recommend to sustainable minds out there that are hoping to shift their mindset specifically to become the change that they want to see in the world?
So I'm going to go back to Mr. McDonough. He wrote the book Cradle to Cradle. It had a 2002 publication date. When I read it in 2005, it absolutely changed my world and opened me up to the concept that you can do well, have a wildly successful business and organization because of going green and sustainable. Not because you followed a mandate, because you just needed it for compliance purposes. But he walks through some amazing examples. And this is back in 2002, before the cost reductions in solar storage and all sorts of other market rules have made it even better. So I encourage everybody to check out the book Cradle to Cradle. It's also written on a very interesting texture. I'll leave that as a little surprise for when you pick the book.
Nice. So we have a lot of young people, a lot of students, both in middle school and high school and even college that listen to this show. If there's someone out there that is interested in getting into renewable energy or maybe even switching careers to renewable energy, what would you suggest is perhaps a good first step to take on that path to make sure that they really get off on the right foot?
It's a great question. I wish somebody asked me this a long time ago, or I learned this question. I would honestly do a podcast and I would interview people that are in the space that you want to learn more about. And the reason I know that this works is my friend Bill just got a job about 4 months ago by doing an informational interview where he just was reaching out to companies saying, hey, new to the solar space. This is what I do. These are the skills I have. I'd like to learn about you and your organization. And I don't know if he just struck gold. The first one he called, they're like, we really like you. This is a great approach. Can we offer you a job? And if you and any listeners are interested, I have put together a spreadsheet resource, because I'm a volunteer mentor with the Solar Ready Vets program, the Department of Energy funded initiative to help transitioning veterans into the solar renewable energy space. It's a little bit, there's some of the resources are specific to veteran, but some of the suggestion that I just gave is on there. And there's also a bunch of different both job recruiters that have reached out to me directly, and then I've gotten their permission to share their information. There's all a ton of just great employment resources, because we all have to get in, take action, and we're going to need a lot of people. So if you're listening and you're looking for work, oh, by the way, I think the stat was 1 in 20 jobs back in 2008, new jobs created from the last economic disaster were because of green energy. It might have been a smaller ratio. I forgot the exact. Please correct me on that, listeners. But there's a ton of work to be done, and we need smart people. We need passionate people, and there's a lot of work to be done. It's complicated. Let's roll up our sleeves and get to work.
Fantastic. If you could be any type of renewable energy, what would you choose and why?
Ooh.
Did I stump you?
It's a fun one. I can say cold fusion. The joke among scientists is that cold fusion is only 20 years away. And they've been saying that forever. I do hope that cold fusion, the magical creating of energy, maybe that's how Star Wars powered their planes to the galaxy. I'm not exactly sure. But cold fusion is so cool. It's the opposite of nuclear fission for the non-energy nerds out there. So instead of splitting energy, it's actually combining it. It is theoretically limitless. Clean, it's great. A lot cheaper than solar, if theoretically it ever gets figured out.
Wow. Thank you. That was a wonderful end to a great interview. Super informative. And luckily, we're at the place that I just moved to a few days ago. I don't have to pay for any utilities. They're all included. But next time I am in a place where I do have to look at utilities, I'll know exactly what I'm looking at with my energy bill. And I'll definitely be passing that info on to my friends and family. So check out Seth on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/in/SethManser. His last name is spelled M-A-N-S-U-R. So our final question, Seth, do you have any words or parting pieces of guidance to give sustainable minds out there?
I do. There is a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of excitement as President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris have come into office. Amazing mandate, 100% green, climate change, you know, carbon negative utility grid by 2035. None of that happens without capital. And though I applaud all of the work to get mandates, what we need is people taking action. If you're a middle schooler, talk to your parents. And start to learn about the energy use of your facility. Talk to your school. Learn about how your school uses energy. And if you're in business and you're looking for ways to risk mitigate and risk manage your organization, start thinking about solar. Add that on the list of the annual evaluations with insurance and taxes. Ultimately, we're all in this together. Whether you are Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, or any other political party, the energy space is transitioning, and there's a lot of opportunity to both create value, and there's also a lot of opportunity to correct a lot of the injustices of the past. And so if you're listening, please plug in. There's a ton of opportunity to help yourselves, help your neighbors, and help.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Seth. This has been a very enlightening and enjoyable episode.
Likewise. I really really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure, Marjorie.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. If you want to learn more about Seth Manser and his work helping corporate, industrial, and large nonprofit clients to reduce their energy usage, you can find Seth on LinkedIn. You can get that link and all other resources mentioned on today's episode in the podcast description. Or head on over to asustainablemind.com/087. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on A Sustainable Mind.